Today on Wings.
Dr. Tia Palermo of Stony Brook University is the lead author of a new study called Tip of the Iceberg, Reporting and Gender-Based Violence in Developing Countries. It was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology in December 2013. The study looks at the degree to which gender-based violence is underreported.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Tia Palermo, who has a master's degree in economics and a PhD in public policy, has had a long-term interest in women's health and reproductive rights. She worked for Family Care International right out of college and continued working on issues of equity and women's health through graduate school and now as assistant professor of preventive medicine and core faculty in the program in public health at Stony Brook School of Medicine. We began the interview with Palermo outlining the purpose of the research.
We know the prevalence of intimate partner violence globally, but what we wanted to do is provide some linkages between the estimates that we see from police reports or hospital-based data and those estimates that we find in population-based data. So we know the global prevalence, but what we wanted to see is if you were to just look at police reports or hospital systems data, how much are you really underestimating the real prevalence of gender-based violence? And this is a very sensitive topic, so we never will truly know the true prevalence of gender-based violence, but the population-based data that we have can give us a little bit better idea about that prevalence.
What is gender-based violence?
That's a good question. So gender-based violence really is an umbrella term for a wide variety of harmful acts of violence typically perpetrated against women. And these are committed based on ascribed gender differences or cultural expectations of the way we think an individual should behave based on their gender or what's expected of them in a particular society. So acts of gender-based violence, they occur across the lifespan, but they might include intimate partner violence and dating violence. There's also non-partner sexual violence, female genital mutilation, battering during pregnancy, sexual abuse in the workplace, forced prostitution, etc. But what most researchers are focusing on when they look at gender-based violence in these prevalence estimates is either physical and sexual intimate partner violence or other forms of physical and sexual violence that are perpetrated by non-partners. So in our study particularly, we focused on all forms of sexual violence, whether perpetrated by a partner or a non-partner, and other forms of physical violence.
Given all of the caveats, still, give me a number. How prevalent is that type of violence in the developing world?
Karen DeVries at the London School and her colleagues, they recently estimated that approximately 1 in 3 women have experienced physical or sexual intimate partner violence. This includes both developed and developing countries. So what we know is that intimate partner violence is the most prevalent form of gender-based violence everywhere. And there's been some preliminary research conducted on the global prevalence of non-partner sexual violence. So this was led by Nima Abrams at the South African Medical Research Unit and her colleagues. They estimate that around the world, approximately 7% of women have experienced sexual violence perpetrated by a non-partner. And this ranges from one region to another. They estimate that it ranges from about 3% in South Asia to about 21% in Central Africa. And then if we want to look at other measures of the prevalence of gender-based violence, Heidi Stockel, also from the London School, and her colleagues found that more than 1 in 3 or 38% of all murders of women are committed by an intimate partner around the world. And this compares to about 6% of male homicides. So you can see that gender-based violence is prevalent both in the developed and developing worlds, and that a majority is perpetrated by intimate partners.
What are some of the physical and psychological consequences of gender-based violence?
There are several reproductive health related physical consequences of gender based violence. So, for example, women who have a lack of sexual autonomy, so perhaps a woman who's not able to refuse sex or use a contraceptive method when she wants to, that's associated with unwanted pregnancy, sexually transmitted infections, HIV, unsafe abortion. Sexual abuse in childhood has been linked to earlier sexual debut, more substance abuse, higher number of sexual partners, and less contraceptive use. Some of the other risks from sexual and physical violence include vaginal and cervical infections, chronic pelvic pain, pelvic inflammatory disease, painful menstruation. A particularly debilitating consequence of sexual violence is what's known as gynecological fistula. So this may also be caused by prolonged labor, but what it is a tear in the wall between the vagina and the bladder or rectum. And when this happens, women may constantly leak either urine and or feces. And in this case, they're often ostracized by their families, their spouses, and their communities. So my colleague Amber Peterman estimated with Kirsten Johnson of ICF Macro that if we were able to eliminate sexual violence in the four African countries they studied, that it would result in a reduction of the total burden of incontinence of between 7 and 40%. Other adverse health outcomes include adverse outcomes in pregnancy. So that might include insufficient weight gain, fetal distress, increased risk of miscarriage, low birth weight, preterm delivery, or fetal growth retardation. And then outside of pregnancy, there are other consequences among women of these types of violence, and that includes physical disability, drug and alcohol abuse, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, eating and sleeping disorders, and gastrointestinal disorders. And all of these effects might vary based on the severity and type of gender-based violence.
What are some of the social and economic consequences of gender-based violence?
Socially, there's widespread shame that's associated with gender-based violence, including intimate partner violence. But in other types of sexual violence, women who are raped by a non-partner may also face rejection from their husbands or family. And a salient example of this is when women are raped or become pregnant in conflict situations. And Jocelyn Kelly at the Harvard Humanitarian Institute has researched this topic, where they interview members of the community and discuss the experience that women have had if they are raped by a non-partner and their partner may reject them, or the community may even put pressure on the partner to reject a woman who's been raped. Some of the economic consequences of gender-based violence, these include not only the costs incurred for medical treatment, but also wages lost either due to missed days of work or lower productivity. There have been some estimates that look at developing countries such as Chile, Nicaragua, Tanzania, and Vietnam. And in those countries, the estimates are that the costs from domestic violence range anywhere from about 1.2 to 2% of the gross domestic product, the GDP, annually. And just to put this into perspective, a lot of poor and middle-income countries spend between 2 and 4% of their GDP annually on education. So the cost of intimate partner violence and domestic violence in these countries is about equal to what the government is spending every year on education. The economic consequences really are far-reaching, and we need to do more work to examine some of these linkages. And then one of the health consequences that I really didn't get into, but that has long-lasting effects, is actually on the impacts that domestic violence and intimate partner violence has on children who are exposed to that in the home. So children who are exposed to intimate partner violence among their parents, they're more likely to grow up to not only be victims of intimate partner violence, but also perpetrators of intimate partner violence, and it has adverse consequences for their health. So research has shown that children who are exposed to intimate partner violence, they have restricted growth in the first 2 years of life. Children who are exposed to intimate partner violence have higher heart rates, salivary cortisol levels, and other outcomes that are related to stress and longer-term health problems. Also, some of the hypothesized pathways is that Mothers who are exposed to intimate partner violence have increased risk of substance abuse, depression, and physical and nutritional symptoms.
Is there a main reason why women don't report gender-based violence?
Commonly, what we do see is that women don't report to the police because there's a general atmosphere of impunity or there's prejudicial attitudes among police and law enforcement. So women feel that nothing will be done to the perpetrator even if they do report. A lot of times this is true in countries with weak institutions, that perhaps those institutions are weak due to conflict or unrest, such as places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. But really, this phenomenon is not limited to conflict situations. There have been, in India, many highly publicized cases of sexual assault last year, and the stories that documented those cases really highlighted the prejudicial attitudes of police towards these sexual violence victims. And someone who's written a lot about this is Lauren Wolf of the Women Under Siege Project. But even here in the U.S., there's also widespread stereotypes or widespread belief among police officers that a lot of the victims who come forward to report sexual violence are lying about being assaulted. And there's been some rigorous research done here in the U.S. and in the United Kingdom that put the percentage of false reports of sexual assault somewhere between 2 and 8%. These stereotypes perpetuate victim blaming among law enforcement. And this is particularly true when the victim knows the perpetrator. There's this idea of this classic rape myth where, you know, most people believe that rape is when a woman is attacked either at knife point or gunpoint by someone she doesn't know, and she's raped, and there's physical evidence of the attack. But what the studies from the CDC and other studies in other places show that most sexual violence is actually committed by attackers the victim know, whether it be an intimate partner or another acquaintance.
So to what extent do they not report because they think violence is normal?
Well, that's really a recurring theme on the research investigating barriers to reporting. Oftentimes, women don't report or seek help because they think the violence either wasn't serious enough to report it, or they just think that violence is a normal part of life that women have to bear. So, for example, in our study, we found that 13% of women in Cameroon and 22% of women in Mali who experienced gender-based violence but didn't report it said the reason they didn't do so was just because it was a normal part of life. And a lot of previous studies have also found that women either justify or have what are called accepting attitudes towards intimate partner violence in a series of hypothetical circumstances that an interviewer might pose to the woman. So some of these might include things like, when women are not fulfilling traditional gender roles, such as neglecting the children, not having dinner ready on time, burning the food, going somewhere without telling her husband. And so these are attitudes that have been studied in many countries. And last year, Rachel Perotti of the University of Michigan, she came out with a study where she examined attitudes in 26 developing countries over time. And she concluded that women are becoming increasingly likely to reject these accepting attitudes of intimate partner violence in 23 out of the 26 countries she studied. And what she hypothesizes is that global diffusion of norms and transnational activities on this issue of gender-based violence and intimate partner violence have really contributed to these trends where women are becoming increasingly likely to reject these attitudes that are accepting of intimate partner violence.
On Wings, you're hearing Dr. Tia Palermo, author of an epidemiological study about the reporting of gender-based violence, interviewed by Kelia Ramirez-Watson.
How can you estimate the percentage of women who do not report in any given country? Isn't that like trying to prove a negative?
That's a good question. So our study aims to analyze evidence from population-based household surveys and make projections regarding statistics which might come from police reports and hospital-based data. So we don't actually, in our current study, analyze the data from police reports and hospital-based data. What we did was analyze data from household surveys. So these are where Household surveys are conducted on a random sample of the population. That's why we call them population-based. And interviewers will go into the home and they'll ask women their experiences with violence in a private setting. So if they're not able to ensure a private setting where other members of the household can overhear what they're talking about, they won't actually conduct the interview. So those are some ethical requirements about interviewing women on this topic. So this type of data is still going to suffer from underreporting because of the sensitive nature of the topic. But by going in and asking women their individual experiences on a one-on-one basis, it's able to give us a more accurate estimate of the percentage of women who've experienced some form of gender-based violence. So what we did in our study is estimate among all the women who said yes, they'd experienced some form of physical or sexual violence, what percentage of those women then reported it to formal sources, or what we called informal reporting to a friend, family member, or neighbor. So police reports and hospital-based records, by definition, can only count the women who've come forward to report or seek help. But we go to the source and ask women, have you experienced violence? And if yes, did you go to any of these formal sources to report it or seek help?
What kind of acts specifically did you consider to be gender-based violence?
We looked only at sexual and physical violence. So sexual violence was any forced sexual debut or any other forced sexual act. And then physical violence was having been hit, slapped, kicked, physically hurt, threatened with a knife or gun. And these acts may have been perpetrated by a partner or non-partner, and they were based on standard validated measures that are utilized across the types of household surveys that I mentioned before.
So it wasn't, for example, psychological violence or withholding of food or something like that?
That's correct. So we did not include those types of psychological and emotional acts of violence in our study. So again, these are going to be lower bounds of estimates of gender-based violence.
And a formal report of gender-based violence was made when a woman reported to what kind of sources?
We grouped the formal sources into three categories. So we looked at police or legal as one source, doctor or medical personnel as a second, and then finally social service organizations, which might include women's nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, or community leaders or religious leaders. And then we also separately looked at informal reporting to a friend, a neighbor, or a family member.
Where are women more likely and where are they least likely to report formally?
Globally, we found that a combined total of only 7% of survivors of gender-based violence, that's physical or sexual violence perpetrated by anyone, including their intimate partners, we found that only 7% formally reported the violence to either police, medical, or social services combined. What we found was that women in Latin America and the Caribbean and Eastern European and Central Asia were more likely to report. And then we found that women in India and East Asia and Africa were least likely to report. Of the 24 countries we studied, the country with the lowest rate of formal reporting to all three of those sources combined was India, where fewer than 1% of women report. And then Colombia had the highest rate, where 26% of survivors of gender-based violence had reported it to formal sources. So we found that there were higher rates of reporting in more developed regions, and really strong institutions are important for reporting and responding to these types of needs. But even though we saw these regional differences, it really masks wide variation within the region. So for example, Latin America had high rates of reporting, but Haiti is an example of an exception because, in fact, Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the world with weaker institutions, and this also had one of the lowest rates of formal reporting in our study.
What's the profile of a woman who's more likely to formally report?
Generally, formerly married women compared to currently married or single women were more likely to report gender-based violence. Increasing age was associated with a higher likelihood of reporting, and women living in urban areas were more likely to report than women living in rural areas.
What are the ways, in your opinion, that the study fell short the most?
For one, we believe that gender-based violence is underreported even in our study due to the sensitive nature of the topic, but also because we don't look at psychological or emotional violence. So if anything, our estimates are going to provide a lower bound of the percentage of women who have formally reported. But second, we can't determine the perpetrators given the data that we use. So we're unable to say whether women are more likely to report if they experience violence from a partner or from a non-partner. And we're also not able to, based on the data we have, examine differences in reporting rates between physical and sexual violence. So we can't say with our data whether women who experience physical violence are more or less likely than women who experience sexual violence to report.
What did you find most enlightening?
What's perhaps surprising about our results is that not only do women not report to formal sources, but in 20 of the 24 countries studied, a majority of women didn't even tell a friend or a family member about what they were going through. So gender-based violence really is still a hidden epidemic, even despite the advances that have been made in targeting services for survivors over the past few years. And this goes to show that there's still a lot of stigma and shame associated with intimate partner violence, since we saw that women weren't even willing to disclose to the people that they were close to. With respect to the formal reporting to the police, medical, or social services, going into this study, we hypothesized that the rates would be low, but in some of the countries we studied, the fact that fewer than 1% of women were reporting was surprising. So in a country like India, 0.1% of all women experiencing gender-based violence report to the police. So this means that for every woman reporting to the police, she represents 1,000 women who are not reporting but still experiencing some form of gender-based violence. So even if we see upward trends in reporting, it's really still just the tip of the iceberg. So any decreases in the prevalence of gender-based violence is really going to come from changing attitudes towards victims, but also from modeling healthy relationships and families for children and young people.
If women are reluctant to report even to a friend, why did some of them come forward to a surveyor?
These are anonymous surveys. I think in some cases, maybe it's cathartic for women to be able to just express to a stranger that they'll never see again that this happened. They've been assured that their answers won't be shared with anybody with any kind of identifying information. So no one in their household will know what they talked about or what they said. And these surveys are anonymous. So even though they'll look at their answers later, they won't be able to connect them back to the particular woman.
What has been a reaction from local women's groups?
We've had a positive response from researchers working on this issue, as well as women's rights groups, such as Women Under Siege, which is a journalism project highlighting sexualized violence around the globe. They particularly focus on the context of conflict. But we hope that the country-specific, as well as the global estimates, will be useful and be able to be utilized by women's groups going forward as they design their interventions and programs.
And what do you hope emerges on the ground for the women from this study?
We hope that this study helps highlight the pervasive, hidden nature of this problem and helps to mobilize resources to not only help survivors, but to pilot innovative new programs aimed at primary prevention of gender-based violence.
Palermo closed the interview by outlining the next research steps.
As a research community, we're really just beginning to understand what works with respect to prevention, particularly in developing countries. So there are some promising programs being piloted, but there really isn't a large evidence base regarding what works to prevent violence. And two areas where there have been promising developments include changing norms on the one hand, and another area is economic empowerment on the other hand among women. In Uganda, there's a promising intervention called SASA Raising Voices, and this is aimed at reducing gender-based violence and preventing HIV. It's a randomized control trial in Uganda, and what the intervention does is walks the communities through a process of change and tries to engage a critical mass of people across all levels of society in order to create social norm change. And on the other side, with economic empowerment, the idea being that as you empower women economically, then violence against them will decrease. In the evidence for this has provided some mixed results. So in some instances, violence might be used as a backlash in changing societies or families where women are beginning to contribute, so men may feel threatened as the breadwinner. The theory from some economists is that as women increase their access to income and assets, it increases what the economists call the outside options and therefore would decrease violence committed by a partner. There have been some economic empowerment programs that I'm sure you're familiar with, the microfinance programs.
Yes.
And from these, the evidence is mixed. So in South Africa, there's a program called IMAGE, which was a microfinance combined with a program to prevent HIV. And this reduced levels of intimate partner violence by 55% over a two-year period. And then researchers looking at some programs in Ecuador, Melissa Idrovo from the International Food Policy Institute, along with my colleague Amber Peterman and Lori Heisey from the London School in Ecuador, they found that there were two anti-poverty programs where women are given cash each month. These are programs that economists call cash transfer programs. So women who were receiving the transfers reported fewer levels or instances of intimate partner violence than women who were not receiving those transfers. So they reported fewer controlling behaviors, less physical violence, and less sexual violence. And similarly, there are some promising results on reductions in intimate partner violence levels from similar cash transfer programs in both Mexico and Peru. We need more evaluations, but what we know is that violence happens within the context of relationships, families, societies, and institutions. So there are factors at each of these levels that contribute to the likelihood a woman will experience violence.
Economic empowerment. The evidence that you're stating that women who are getting monetary transfers are experiencing less violence runs counter, I think, to the possible thought that, well, the partner wants her money and so he'll attack her.
Yes, there are different hypotheses of how these transfers would influence the levels of violence. And in fact, even though overall in the cash transfer program Oportunidades that's in Mexico, at an overall level, they've found a reduction in violence levels among women who received the transfers. But in a subset of households where men had lower levels of education, the reverse was actually found. So there are different dynamics at play here. I'm interested in evaluating interventions related to economic empowerment, as well as interventions that are targeted towards young teens, perhaps in school or similar environments, as they begin to form their first partnerships.
You've been listening to Dr. Tia Palermo, lead author of a new study called Tip of the Iceberg, Reporting and Gender-Based Violence in Developing Countries. It was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology in December 2013. For Wings, I'm Kelly Ramirez Watson in Oakland, California.
Special thanks this week to donor stations WERU Blue Hill, Maine, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, and WORT Madison, Wisconsin, and to all the community radios that air Wings around the world. Thanks also to Janice Cohen, to Suzette Cullen, and to Genevieve Vaughn, who is now working on a new book, The Gift in the Heart of Language. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.